All right. Welcome to the Bitcoin Bottom Line with myself, Stephen McClurg, and CJ Wilson. We have a very special guest today, Charlie Lee, also known as Satoshi Lite.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Charlie. Thanks for coming on. Man.
Yeah.
So, Charlie, I'm it's a privilege to know you. You're a legend. You've been around for a while, and you've also built one of the coolest coins out there. But I kind of want to start off and ask how you got into Bitcoin, and when did you first acquire your first Bitcoin? And, you know, tell me the story on it.
Yeah, so this was like a little bit over 10 years ago. It's a long time, 2011. I remember reading an article about Silk Road and how Bitcoin was the only currency accepted. And I really gravitated towards what Bitcoin was or is. The first thing I did was print out the white paper. And then I left the white paper on my desk for like a week before I actually got a chance to read it. And finally, after reading the white paper, I really like bought in, right? And I bought some Bitcoin. This was when Bitcoin was at the all-time high at that point, which was an all-time high of $30. I bought my first Bitcoin from Mike Hearn, who was also at Google at the time. I was working as a software engineer at Google. And he was a big proponent of Bitcoin actually inside Google. So I bought my first Bitcoin from him and then watched the price fall all the way down to like $2 over the next few months. So that was the first crash. Actually, probably the first major crash of Bitcoin ever.
Well, it's funny because, you know, today, you know, we just hit an all-time high right at 69,000 and we just went all the way back down to 59,000 a day. People are panicking. There's blood in the street. That's nothing like $30.
That's nothing. Yeah. Yeah. From $30 to two, it's like going from 69 to like, was like $4,000.
Right. So I guess my question is like, has the freak out emotional aspect of the buying and selling cycle, has it changed at all for like, in your opinion, of market sentiment, or is it more just like, the memes are just better now, you know, or is it the same freak out?
The memes are definitely better. So back then, the only place where people talked about Bitcoin was on the Bitcoin Talk forum. So there was no Twitter, there was no Instagram, Facebook or whatever. So, I mean, there was, but people weren't talking about Bitcoin there. So it was on Bitcoin Talk forum, people were posting to the threads. People were freaking out for sure when it went from 32 to $2, but the community was very small, like maybe 1,000, 10,000 people. And definitely not like today. No memes. But I think a lot of people, myself included, did not lose faith in the coin, right? We still believe that Bitcoin was going to come back strong, and it's a long-term play. So you buy more, right? So it's cheaper at $2 than at 30. So, I mean, that's what most people did, and they got paid off. They did well in the long term.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't go back to Mike and say, hey, man, you totally scammed me. You just sold me this no. Bitcoin at $30. Like, I want my money back, right?
No, I only bought like one Bitcoin from him, if I remember correctly. So it wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
It's funny to think about, you know, buying one Bitcoin at $30, which is like for today's standards, you know, that's basically 20,000 sats or 30,000 sats or something like that. You know, I mean, it's not even a representable fraction. Just what it must have been like to take such a leap of faith to the technology of Bitcoin so early, you know, because I mean, I'm from 2018. That's when I really got into Bitcoin. I had heard about it in 13 and 14, but to be in it in 11, 10 or 11 or 12 or whatever, when Bitcoin was so unadopted, and like you said, there's nowhere really to talk about it other than like a very specific, like one specific place. It just seems like there's this Smithsonian museum of information now, you know, relatively to what it was like then.
Well, back then, it was kind of like play money, right? It's not real money. It's not really accepted anywhere. It reminded me of SETI at home, where I don't know if you guys are familiar, where people would use their computer screensaver to search for extraterrestrial radio waves, right? And they would like try to study to see if they would find anything odd, right, from the radio waves that we're receiving. And people do that. So instead of doing that, you could be mining Bitcoin with your computer in this fake or virtual currency that's not really worth anything, that's like kind of like play money. So yeah, so you really didn't know where it was going to go, but I thought that it was something very innovative and it'll become big. But yeah, totally didn't expect it to, it kind of like blew away my original extremely bullish expectations already.
Right. Well, and you said once it dropped from $30 to $2, you sort of backed up the truck and decided, oh, well, it's much cheaper now. I still believe in it. Obviously you were buying from 2011 all the way up to, 2013. And so how were you accessing Bitcoin back then? Were you going to an exchange? Were you just buying it off of people? How did that work?
Yeah. So, back then the main exchange, maybe even like the only one when I first started was Mt. Gox. It was exchange in Japan. You had to like wire money to Japan, which is complicated. And then they also had like a payment method called Dwolla, where you would do ACH transfer to Dwolla and Dwolla would deposit the money with Mt. Gox. It all seemed very shady and complicated and took forever to get money into the exchange. And then once it's there, I think there's only market orders. I don't remember doing any limit orders. You just basically said, I want to buy. And then you just get some Bitcoin and then you can withdraw it to your own wallet. And pretty much everyone used Bitcoin Core. That was like I don't remember if there were any mobile wallets, probably not when I first started. So you just withdraw your Bitcoins to Bitcoin Core, and then you send them around and they're like, it's like play money, right? I send it to some people and it's cool. It works. And you can't really use it to buy anything. So it's just something, right?
Right, right.
So yeah, I've also bought Bitcoin with local Bitcoin, where you meet up with someone nearby and you give them cash and they give you Bitcoin.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I remember doing that a few times myself. It was pretty interesting.
That's something I would never do anymore.
No.
Especially I would never do, but I wouldn't recommend anyone to ever do buy Bitcoin like in person. It's kind of a very dangerous thing today.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Mt. Gox, obviously ended up going down. How did you deal with that situation? I mean, did you sort of see it coming? Did you pull your money out, in time or are you still dealing with trying to recover funds out of Mt. Gox?
Thankfully, I'm not dealing with that. I normally don't leave coins on exchange in the first place. I always just withdraw it to my own wallet. But I sort of did see it coming. They were having issues. They had like a flash crash to like, was it like 10 cents or something? They've had a lot of technical issues in, I want to say 2012, mid 2012, summer 2012. And I basically stopped using them. That's when other exchanges were around. So Mt. Gox wasn't like the only one. It's also when Mt. Gox crash like went down after I started working at Coinbase. So Coinbase already started, and Coinbase was a good place to buy and sell Bitcoin already. So yeah, so I definitely stopped using Mt. Gox by then, by 2013.
Yeah, I mean, would you recommend people holding their Bitcoin in exchanges today?
I would say no, unless. So for certain people who are not very technical, exchanges can protect their coins better than they can themselves. Like, I think it might be even more dangerous to tell these people to to hold their own coins, because they will screw up and actually like lose access to the coins or misplace their 12 word seed or 24 word seed and their hardware device and just totally lose it, right? So for certain people, leaving on exchange is actually safer. But for people who are more technical, who can actually like do it themselves, I would definitely recommend doing it themselves. And for people who can't really do it themselves, probably like an ETF is a better bet than buying coins and leaving on exchange.
Yeah.
So my question is, what were the early days of Coinbase like? Because obviously that's become such a big standard in the industry now. And I think a lot of people are seeing like a super developed product with a huge marketplace. There's tons of users, millions of users, obviously. But when you were going from, let's say, the early days of Bitcoin and Mt. Gox into Coinbase as a user, what was it like having more players in the market in that regard? Because I'm, you know, so out of my depth there to imagine what that would have been like rewinding the clock that way.
Yeah. So Coinbase back then, at least initially, it was just a brokerage kind of setup where you would just buy from Coinbase. You buy coins from Coinbase or you sell coins to Coinbase. They set a price and that's the price you get. So it's not like right now they have the exchange and where you can put in limit orders and market orders and such. But back then, initially, it was just a brokerage service. And that made it really easy for people to buy Bitcoin. And I think that's one of the reasons why I joined Coinbase, because Coinbase was making Bitcoin easy for people to use. And that was important for Bitcoin to succeed. It has to be easy. Like the on and off ramps have to be easy for people to get into, right? So and when I joined Coinbase, Coinbase was still very small. I was the second engineer. There was like five people there. And we basically deal with fires every other day, because I joined in 2013, mid-2013, and then by late 2013, it was like the second like bull run. It went all the way up to like 1,000 to 1,200, something like that. And the demand on Coinbase was just ridiculous. So many people wanted to buy Bitcoin. It's crazy where at the all-time high, everyone wants to buy. That's when everyone gets in, or like the 90% of the new users get in at all-time high. And that's always been the case. So yeah, so Coinbase would go down, not dissimilar from what happens even today with Coinbase going down when there's a big market move. But yeah, so dealing with a lot of fires, the customer support issues and everything else. It was pretty crazy times.
I mean, could you imagine Coinbase operating today with only five people, right? I mean,
yeah, I think, what is it now? Like 5,000 people, maybe?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Now, what drove you to create Litecoin? Because, you know, I look at it, you know, today, you know, there's all of these applications that are being built, layer twos, that like the Lightning Network, that allows you to transact Bitcoin, you know, much faster, and then they kind of settle on the block later. But back then, there wasn't that concept really didn't exist. And Litecoin, I remember when Litecoin came out, it was like, oh, it's like a faster, cheaper Bitcoin, essentially. It's like the silver to gold, and that's what a lot of people compared it to. You know, if you wanted to make smaller transactions, you use Litecoin. If you do bigger ones, you use Bitcoin. But what was it? What was it that compelled you to create Litecoin to begin with?
Yeah, one thing that compelled me was just how slow Bitcoin was, right? So 10 minutes, I mean, there's a reason why Satoshi chose 10 minutes for settling of Bitcoin transactions. But I always thought it was a little bit too conservative. So for example, like back then when I was doing local Bitcoin transactions, I would meet up with someone, a stranger at a Starbucks or even a McDonald's, and I would basically like give them cash and then wait there for a transaction to confirm, right? Even back then, like unconfirmed transactions are a little bit risky. So normally 10 minutes, a block happens and I'm happy we split and I have my Bitcoins, he has his cash, right? And then we're fine. But every now and then I would be actually waiting there for an hour for a confirmation, just like talking to this stranger, trying to hoping that he's not trying to scam me. So that's very, that's kind of awkward. And I figured with Litecoin, doing something that's faster, even like at 2.5 minutes block times, worst case, it's 10 minutes where, before you get a block,
right?
For the most part, right? So just even just that experience is like 100 times better.
Right. I mean, I'm just imagining, you know, going on Craigslist and having somebody say, hey, I've got Bitcoin for sale for cash, and meeting them in some like, you know, truck stop, and a guy like CJ Wilson pops up and he's like, hey, I got some Bitcoin for you. You got my cash. And I mean, it's just, it sounds super shady, but
it's grimy for sure. Definitely like a grimy process to do the thing. I mean, the funny thing is like, there's that one Starbucks that's right in downtown San Francisco, like in the financial district, where a lot of people were like doing local Bitcoins, right? Which is funny because it's also the same, it's like the same building as, isn't like, there's like a federal, investigation office there or something like that. It's like, there's like a FDIC or like a banking office or something like on the 8th floor. So it's sort of ironic to think of how technical Bitcoin has, you know, always was or intended to be, but then there was like this really truck stop grimy, like, hey kids, like, look what I got. I got some Bitcoin in here. You know what I mean? And then to think of that, and then to think also that that guy is leaving with physical cash, right? So he's vulnerable because now he's leaving with cash and you know who it is, right? Yeah. So it's like kind of both ways. It's a very interesting thing.
I remember back then I did meet someone like at a bank once because he wanted to do it at a bank. So we're in the bank lobby exchanging cash for Bitcoin. I've also done it once outside a police station, at the steps of a police station. So it's definitely an experience that I'll probably never ever do again. Not probably, I'll definitely never ever do again. But it feels like you're dealing drugs or something.
Yeah, it's like, hey, meet me at the zoo over by the monkey cage and then we'll do it.
Oh man, that's wild. Oh, that's great. Well,
so when did local Bitcoins, like, I guess, sort of start tapering off? Is that through the Silk Road process? Is that when, like, after people started getting in trouble for Silk Road, is that when?
I'm not sure it actually has tapered off. I mean, I don't use it personally, but I do know a lot. It's still very popular, especially in other countries, right, where the exchange infrastructure is likely not as good as in the U.S., where buying Bitcoin from people is like the best way to acquire Bitcoins. So I do know that people still use local Bitcoin or whatever it is today. There's lots of sites that do something similar to local Bitcoins.
Yeah. When was the last time you bought Bitcoin for cash from a stranger?
Probably 2013 or 2012. Maybe 2012, yeah.
And that was about the time when people were starting to, you know, get in cars with strangers too, right? You know, that's when Uber came up.
I stopped doing that when people started knowing who I am. When I would buy Bitcoins or from someone and they'll be like, hey, aren't you Charlie Lee? I'm like, okay, this is about time to stop.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things that's really interesting is that, you know, I think that Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general has obviously been best oriented towards private transactions, even though they're peer-to-peer. So sort of balancing out that one-on-one versus the anonymity or the pseudonymity is one of the coolest things that's happened. Because like most exchanges in terms of value for thousands of years have been, you go somewhere, you buy something in person. But if you're buying something that's maybe like, you know, somewhat like you go to a lingerie store and you're buying something for your wife or whatever, or your girlfriend or your girlfriend's wife, or I don't know whatever's cool these days, you know, it is interesting because you've got to do it in person in a lot of ways. But since mail order and the sort of like cryptography and all that stuff has basically revolutionized the payment networks and payment rails across the world, it seems like it's much different than when we were all kids, when there was no mail order stuff, and now you can effectively buy Bitcoin or Litecoin or anything anonymously through a clearinghouse or through an exchange. It's like, it's like, oh man, why didn't we think of that? You know, like why did it take so long to have that process there? You know, that's because it seems so obvious now that that was such a better way to do things and transact.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what are your favorite, I mean, we talk about this all the time, CJ and I, about, you know, transactions that we do in Bitcoin, right? So as a matter of fact, CJ, I went and bought a car on Saturday. I finally pulled the trigger on a truck. I've been waiting. Like there's no inventory whatsoever. And there was finally one available that I wanted. And for the down payment, I said, well, will you take Bitcoin? And they're like, we don't even know what that is. Like, how do I do that? Right. And I know in your dealership, CJ, you will take Bitcoin. Absolutely. Like somebody says, can I pay in Bitcoin? Yeah. It's like, yeah, how much? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the challenges today is the accounting aspect of how are you valuing that on intake, you know, versus dollars. Some people expect to get a discount because they're paying in Bitcoin because they know the future value of their Bitcoin. Other people are expecting that because it's a little bit more of a transactional hindrance, you know, in some ways, that they'll have to pay extra. So I think what's happening is we're still seeing that sort of, I'll call it like market discovery of the service of accepting Bitcoin for goods. It's still very, very early. And a lot of companies don't know how to process it because they don't know what they're supposed to do with it after they receive it. You could say, hey, set up a wallet here, you can receive it. But then it's like, do you keep a percentage of it? Do you keep all of it? Like, you know, how does that work? Depending on the goods, I try to keep all of it if I receive it and then use the profits of the business to sort of backfill the cost of the goods in that regard, because I would rather have more Bitcoin through the company than less. But right. I think that the funny thing is there's obviously certain currencies that are better to receive because, you know, there's more liquidity in the market. So if someone wanted to pay in, like, let's say Litecoin, Bitcoin, Ethereum, you know, maybe Solana, but definitely like USDC or USDT, I would accept all of those. But if someone wants to pay in like Shiba Inu and they want to pay like $300,000 for a Turbo S, then like I can't accept that because I don't know how I'm going to end up selling that. There's just not enough liquidity there. So you have to have like that sort of exit path planned out if you're going to be a business. Or you have to use a service like OpenNode or whatever, where you're basically, you know, only keeping a percent and the rest of it you're getting in cash. But I think that's like the next frontier for cryptocurrency transactions is that, you know, the meat space point of sale in that regard. And I think that's where Lightning is obviously trying to go these days. But I can see how, you know, other people are sort of campaigning for various other altcoins or whatever to function as that transaction layer as well. It just depends on, for me, it's all based on what's the liquidity of that particular, you know, protocol.
Right.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the business, whether or not they actually want to keep the Bitcoin or not. If they just want to accept crypto as like a payment method, it's probably better for them to use a service like OpenNode or BitPay or any other ones where the service will actually take whatever dollar amount they want that is for the item, they would convert it to Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency, and then they will do all the conversions for the business, so the business doesn't have to worry about it.
Yeah,
I like to ride the Lightning a little bit. So I sold a Boxster a couple of months ago for Bitcoin, and I kept as much of it as I could because I felt like I was pretty bullish, and I was like, hey, Bitcoin's going 38 right now, so like maybe, you know, I hold on to this and it goes up to 45, and then I can sell it in like a week or two. So as an entrepreneurial sort of like day trader type person, that's active in the market, it's more fun for me to receive cryptocurrency because it gives me something extra to do to potentially have an upside. Now, granted, there's a risk to that, right? You could, yeah. But if you're receiving it into a liquid, like a heavy liquid exchange, then you can kind of do that on your own, which I think is going to be a great way for people like me to make extra money because you can only charge so much for a product, right? So then the question is, what's the value you're receiving in exchange for that product that we all agree is going to cost, you know, whatever. You can't necessarily mark things up to the moon. And I think that's where some businesses try that and they don't, it pisses customers off. Whereas, you know, I've bought cars for Bitcoin and sold cars for Bitcoin back and forth, or USDC or USDT. No, I've had people try to pay me in Dogecoin for something, which I've refused. I said, no, you have to convert that to something that I can actually get out of. But I think it is really what's going to be the next development in the space is to have a wider variety of merchants really actually transacting in it. Because there's enough liquidity in the market to justify, you know, receiving it realistically.
Yeah, I do think it's the next step, right? Right now it's very speculative. So it'll take us from a speculative state to a more kind of payments where people actually use it to buy things.
Yeah. Well, and also I look at it like this, you know, again, just this week, Bitcoin has dropped 8.5%, right? And people always say, well, it's so volatile. How can you really use it for payments? How's this even going to work? But when you look at that kind of like sometimes that one day drop and you zoom out, it's like, okay, it's sort of those drops sort of disappear. But at the same time, I look at things. I mean, we just talked about buying cars. I mean, how fast are the prices of cars going up right now? Right. You've got inflation, you've got supply chain issues, even food. Right. I mean, I'll go to the market and a week later, steaks will be 30% higher. Right. If that's not volatility, I don't know what is. Right. And you just people have this hoarding mentality when prices start going up. Right. It's like toilet paper in Costco during COVID. Right. Everybody was like, oh, you know, I got to buy all this toilet paper because of COVID. And then later on, the prices actually started going up because there's less of it. There's more dollars and you've got this massive, you know, a massive inflationary pressure. So, you know, 8% is like, you know, the dollar has a lot more volatility than that.
Yeah. So, I mean, right now, Bitcoin is volatile, but I think the in the long term, it will be less and less volatile. Right. And that's how I see it play out. And before we know it, dollar will become a lot more volatile than Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're getting there already though. I mean, I really do. You know, the law of large numbers is starting to apply to Bitcoin. It's fixed supply. It's already the size of the Swiss franc as far as market cap goes. Mm-hmm. And it's getting less and less volatile as it gets more and more adoption. Yep. And the dollar, even though it's widely adopted, it's getting more and more volatile because of, you know, money printing. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're going to get there. I think we will.
Switching gears a little bit, Charlie, my question is, as someone who's sort of like been in the space for a really long time and various roles between the exchange and obviously Litecoin, how do you see the broad space evolving in terms of like proliferation of, you know, new altcoins and stuff like that continually, or the sort of wars between altcoins to sort of to do those different functions and stuff like that? Like we're seeing Ethereum and Solana sort of like have this little bit of a battle right now for who's doing the better smart contract platform or something. I mean, do you see this as like going to continue for the next 10, 20 years because there's a lot of incentive to do it? Or do you see eventually there'll be a bigger segregation between Bitcoin and then meme coins and stuff like that?
I think it will continue. I mean, there's always room for improvement. And it's kind of special where we're actually seeing it like in real time with like a price attached to it, right? Previously, like if it's like two companies competing or something, it's not as like fast paced as it is today with like Solana and Ethereum. They're all trying to do like one up each other, right? Do it better than the other coin. And I think it will continue. You know, it's just good for the whole space where just trying to find the best solution, if you have something that's really better than Ethereum at doing like smart contract platform, then that's great, right? And similarly, if you have something that's actually better than Bitcoin at being money, then that's awesome, right? But I mean, you had to really be that much better than Bitcoin to actually overtake Bitcoin. I don't think we'll see that. And Bitcoin is always improving. So, but competition is good.
Yeah. Well, talking of competition, I mean, you know, you created Litecoin and I love the way that you created it. You created it in a very similar way that Bitcoin was created, with, you know, smaller block sizes, faster transaction speed, cheaper to transact. Where do you really see, you know, where do you really see Litecoin fitting in commerce? You know, is it for some of the smaller transactions still, or is it? I mean, I noticed that there's a credit card that's now attached to Litecoin where it instantly converts. You know, is it those types of transactions? You know, where are you seeing its place in the ecosystem?
Well, in terms of like on-chain transactions, Litecoin can definitely do. It's fast and it's cheap, right? Transactions are pennies or sub pennies, and you see people moving like hundreds of millions of dollars of Litecoin in one transaction and having it confirm in 2.5 minutes and paying like a few cents for it. So that's pretty incredible. But then in the end, Litecoin is still trying to find its place, right? So Bitcoin has Lightning Network, which is moving along pretty well, right? Lightning Network, where people can send Bitcoins instantaneously, pay very little fees. So where I see Litecoin kind of going right now, we're at least I am focused on adding more fungibility and privacy to Litecoin. So I see like fungibility is one of like the key features of money that is missing from Bitcoin and Litecoin. I would say like when I saw Bitcoin, I first initially like found out about Bitcoin, I saw it like as a better version of gold. And it's almost like perfect money, except for one thing, which is fungibility. Like one Bitcoin is not always the same as another Bitcoin because of the history attached to it, right? So you hear stories about people sending coins from a darknet marketplace to Coinbase, and then Coinbase shuts down their account because of that. So having financial privacy is very important. So that's one thing I'm working on for Litecoin. And we're doing that with a extension block, adding a technology called Mimblewimble, just trying to make the coin more fungible. I think that's good for making it better money.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So then on that note, like you said about the privacy aspect, do you see privacy coins like Zcash and Monero like sort of birthing technical ideas that are adopted by other coins? Because I think that's one of the most interesting things about cryptocurrency in general, is that you can affect the protocol to upgrade, you know, the nodes and upgrade the coin itself, right? Through the code. Taproot obviously just activated recently with Bitcoin. And I know there's some sort of like, hey, we're going to try this over here, and then somebody else adopts it and says, hey, we can try Mimblewimble, maybe we can try it over here. There's a lot of different cross-pollination, I guess is the right way to say it. I think that's one of the healthiest things that I see in the developer landscape, where you have people really genuinely interested in new ideas. And then one coin might try that and it might not work. And then the other coins are like, oh, well, you know, this is where they got that wrong, you know, because you have people that are developing like pretty much on one protocol, you know, specifically. You don't have people that are developing, you know, you don't have an Ethereum developer that's developing on Litecoin that's also writing Bitcoin stuff at the same time, right? It's usually people are kind of staying in their lanes in that regard.
Yeah. Well, like, for example, with Mimblewimble on Litecoin, Mimblewimble was first adopted by two coins, right? Beam and Grin. And they have their own, like, inflation policy. It's kind of creating a new coin with just Mimblewimble. So I think Mimblewimble on Litecoin will be more successful because it's on the established coin that's already on all the exchanges and has a 10-year history. So we actually hired a developer that worked on Grin, on the C++ implementation of Grin, to work on Mimblewimble for us. So yeah, I think it's good. It's good for the space where different coins are trying different things and see what works. And who knows, right? If it works really well on Litecoin, maybe something like this would happen on Bitcoin. But yeah, so I think it's good for the whole space to keep trying different things and see what works.
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest arguments against other coins that are used as a currency is that Bitcoin wasn't pre-mined. It's all proof of work, 100%. And most other coins aren't, are pre-mined. Now, Litecoin sort of wasn't pre-mined at all. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why that was important to you? And and what it was like creating that very first block.
Yeah. So before Litecoin, there were actually a few, almost like a dozen other altcoins, and pretty much all of them were pre-mined. Like one had like 7 million tokens. And I saw that as bad for just, if you want your coin to become like a global decentralized cryptocurrency, it has to be fair, right? You don't want like anyone to be holding 25%, 50% of the stock, and for that person to become a trillionaire when the coin becomes popular, right? So I made it I put an extra effort to make it fair, where everyone had equal chance to mine blocks. And I, just like anyone else, had to mine the blocks or the Litecoins. And I bought Litecoins on exchanges. So creating the Genesis block for Litecoin was actually a lot more complicated than people would expect, because so most of the code, or pretty much all the code for Litecoin, is forked from Bitcoin. The only thing that Bitcoin didn't have was actually the code to create the Genesis block. That was something that Satoshi never checked in with the Bitcoin code base, because it wasn't needed once he created the first one. I think I had like a snippet of the code he used. I don't remember where that code came from, but I reverse engineered a lot of it to just create the first Genesis block. And that was a little bit complicated. And I had to run it on my computer for, I think, like 4 or 6 hours before I found the first block. So that's how Litecoin started. And yeah, I made sure that, just like what Satoshi did, putting like a quote from a recent newspaper, a headline in Litecoin. So I put a quote about Steve Jobs just passed away. So there was an article about that. So I put that quote in the Litecoin Genesis block.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. I didn't realize that was in there.
It doesn't really matter. Yeah. It's an interesting tidbit of information.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect anything.
No, but it's great trivia. It's great
trivia.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, Charlie, I really appreciate you coming on and giving us giving us a snippet of what it was like. Back when Bitcoin was early, all the shadiness, the characters at Starbucks that you came across. I mean, this is it's really cool. Is there anything else you want to kind of close us in as far as what Litecoin's doing or some other cool things that's happening on Litecoin?
Other than this Mimblewimble stuff, I think it's going to be very interesting. So what we're doing is a soft fork. So it's an optional upgrade where people can move coins from the main chain to this extension block. It's kind of like, I see it similar to a side chain, but it's kind of an attached side chain. And once you've moved your Litecoins to the Mimblewimble side chain, we were calling it MWeb, it's then all the transaction uses the Mimblewimble protocol from there on. And then if you want, you can always move the coins back to the main chain. So I don't see any exchanges supporting the Mimblewimble side of things. They can always just, they don't have to do anything, right? Wallets don't have to do anything for this upgrade. They can just keep on supporting Litecoin like normal. And if your coins are in the Mimblewimble side, the M website, if you want to move it back to your main chain, you just peg out, and it's very simple. So hopefully we're still working on it. One launch it, actually get the code out by end of the year, and try to get it adopted ASAP when miners signal for it. So it'll be very exciting when this goes live.
So the one question I wanted to ask to finish was, how do you see mining, whether it's with Litecoin, Bitcoin, Ethereum, any of the other like really main protocols, how do you see that evolving with ASICs and ASIC programming and ASIC build out, kind of being what it is? Because I still see there's a lot of people that they feel like they might be too late to mining. Do you still feel like there's opportunity there regardless of the coin that they're going after?
I think there's always going to be opportunity, but mining is not for everyone, right? So in order for you to actually make money from mining, you have to have access to hardware. You have to have a good location where electricity is cheap. So I wouldn't recommend mining for the average person, right? It's kind of a business these days. And yeah, I don't see any issues with that. I think mining will continue. And I always do see proof of work as kind of the real innovation in this space. Bitcoin and Litecoin will continue to be proof of work. And yeah, and it's going to be, I think it leads to better decentralization of the coin.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, look, I really appreciate you coming on, Charlie. And, thank you for all of the contributions you've made to the network and to the ecosystem. And, we certainly wish you the best of luck and all your future endeavors as well.
Sure. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Charlie.